Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we continue our new weekly series, The Authoritarian Playbook. Every week, we'll do our best to summarize the latest news, put it in historical context, and find out how people are responding. More than 2,200 National Guard troops continue to walk the streets of Washington, D.C. Some are now armed. Donald Trump is now threatening to send troops to other cities, including Baltimore, San Francisco, Oakland, and Chicago. Here is Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker responding to Trump's threats. He said no one in the federal government has reached out. He also called Trump a wannabe dictator.
Donald Trump wants to use the military to occupy a U.S. city, punish his dissidents, and score political points. Earlier today in the Oval Office, Donald Trump looked at the assembled cameras and asked for me personally to say, "Mr. President, can you do us the honor of protecting our city?" Instead, I say, "Mr. President, do not come to Chicago. If you hurt my people, nothing will stop me, not time or political circumstance, from making sure that you face justice under our constitutional rule of law." As Dr. King once said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
That was Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, and here is Trump.
You know, when I have some slob like Pritzker criticizing us before we even go there, I made the statement that next should be Chicago, because as you all know, Chicago is a killing field right now. And they don't acknowledge it. And they say, we don't need him. Freedom, freedom. He's a dictator. A lot of people are saying maybe we like a dictator. I don't like a dictator. I'm not a dictator. I'm a man with great common sense and I'm a smart person. And when I see what's happening to our cities, and then you send in troops, instead of being praised, they're saying you're trying to take over the republic. These people are sick.
Today's guest, Professor Barbara Walter, is an expert on civil wars, violent extremism, and domestic terror. In her latest Here Be Dragons Substack piece, she writes, quote, "The thing that scares me most about America's future is not the next election, the Supreme Court, or even the possibility of political violence, although all of them scare me. It's the police state being built around us in real time, disguised as something meant to protect us." She goes on to write, "We have time, but if we stay silent and complacent until the police state is fully built, the only people left in the streets will be the ones with military gear, and they will feel emboldened to act because they will think that the rest of us really don't care." Dr. Barbara Walter is Rohr Professor of International Relations at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. She's also author of How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them, and the Substack newsletter, Here Be Dragons, Warning Signs from the Edges of Democracy. Hi, Professor Walter. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I want to ask you about how fast things are moving. I've been struck by the guests that have been on our show saying that they just were shocked. They didn't know how fast things would move. Last week, Kurt Weiland, professor at the University of Texas at Austin, said, "I have to admit, I am feeling significantly worse today because I had not anticipated the aggressive and transgressive attack that Donald Trump would unleash." What are your thoughts on how fast things are moving?
Oh, it's unprecedented. In fact, it's almost unprecedented in history. If you look at how democracies have declined in the 21st century, they all do it in a similar pattern. And think about Viktor Orban in Hungary. He sort of led the way on this new strategy. They get elected legally in democracies. They come in on populist movements, and then once they're in power, they very slowly, secretly, systematically begin to weaken the institutions of democracy. So they change a little bit here, and they change a little bit there, and they fire some people, and they put in other people, but they do it quite slowly. And what's so different about Trump, since he came to power in January, is how unbelievably fast and public And obviously, he has done this all. And he was able to do this in large part because he was in power, you know, from 2016 to 2020, and he learned a lot. And then he had 4 years with him and a team of hundreds of really smart conservatives to put together this document by the Heritage Foundation that allowed him to step in and just take power really quickly. This is so unprecedented. I can't even emphasize that enough.
We did a series on Project 2025 last year because we felt like it just wasn't getting the coverage that it deserved.
Yes.
And it was really striking just to see how organized they were. And also, they shared most of their plans with the public. It eventually all came out.
So this is what dictators do, and it's really quite extraordinary. Throughout history, they don't hide their intentions. They're often very, very public about it. If you look at Mao in China had his little red book. It outlined what he planned to do. If you look at Hitler, he had Mein Kampf. Most Americans haven't read that, but if you're interested, read it in English. It outlines exactly what he ended up doing. They're not shy about advertising their intentions. They're actually quite proud of it. And that what's astonishing is that people don't take it seriously. It's almost as if what they're saying is so extreme and so unbelievable that people think it's a joke, and it isn't.
This is such an important point, because what struck me when we did our Project 2025 series, people called in and emailed us and said, come on, that can never happen in the United States.
And of course it can. The United States already has had a civil war. It had one of the bloodiest civil wars in any country in history. That happened here. We have it in us to turn violent. We also had a non-democracy in this country in the 11 Confederate states for most of our history. The rest of the country was a democracy, but the 11 states of the Confederacy didn't become a true democracy until the civil rights movement forced them to in the 1960s. So we certainly have it in us to be both undemocratic, deeply undemocratic, and to be violent. And we have real examples of that.
Can you tell us a bit about your background? Because that really shapes what you're saying right now. You have spent your career studying civil conflict. You have written many books. I'll name just a couple of them. Reputation and Civil War, Why Separatist Conflicts Are So Violent, Civil Wars, Insecurity and Intervention, Territoriality and Conflict in an Era of Globalization, and then your latest, How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them.
Yeah. So I started studying civil wars in 1990, right after or right during the fall of the Soviet Union, when the world seemed to be rapidly changing and nobody really knew what was going to come next. Most people thought we were going to enter this wonderful era of peace and democracy and prosperity. And at first it looked like we were. And then if you looked beneath the surface, what you saw was the rise of a lot of smaller wars within countries. So in Somalia, in Yugoslavia, in Rwanda, and they actually turned out to be the really long-lasting, very difficult to end, and quite brutal. And we didn't have an explanation for that. So in 1990, I started studying civil wars and why they started, why they lasted as long as they did, and why they were so hard to end. In 2017, I was asked to serve on a task force run by the US government called the Political Instability Task Force. And the goal of the task force was to come up with a model that would help our government predict what countries around the world were likely to experience political instability and political violence within the next 2 years. And this was a really, really interesting model, because when it was put together, the analysts who worked for the government asked the academics, the experts like myself, what were all the factors that could potentially lead a country towards violence and instability? And we gave them 38 different factors, things like whether a country was really poor, whether it had lots of discrimination, whether it was ethnically and religiously mixed or homogeneous, anything that we thought could increase the risk of violence and instability. And when the analysts came back and they'd figured out what their model, what the very best model looked like, they said only two factors mattered, and they weren't the two factors that the experts thought would be important. The two factors turned out to be, the first and most important one was this variable that political scientists call anocracy. All that means is it's a government that it's a partial democracy. It's a government that has some elements of democracy, but some elements of authoritarianism. So an example would be a country that holds elections. People go to vote. They're excited to vote. But basically, they have no choice in who eventually wins, or the same party wins again and again and again. So it has elements of both. The second factor was whether political parties in these anocracies were basically formed around identity rather than ideology. So instead of joining a political party because you were conservative or liberal, or you were a communist or a capitalist, you joined a political party because you were white, or you were Black, or you were Christian, or you were Muslim, or you were Serb, or you were Croat. So it turns out that if a country had these two features, if it was a partial democracy and its citizens were choosing political parties based on their identity over everything else, those countries were considered at high risk of political violence and political instability within the next 2 years. And we on the task force would put that country on something we called the watch list, and we sent that watch list to the White House. So here we have, here in the United States, we've been monitoring countries around the world based on their level of democracy, based on whether their democracies are declining, based on whether their populations were breaking down along these sort of rigid racial, religious, and ethnic lines. And if they were, we were worried.
I wonder, given your background, how you see the United States, because here we have a country of about 340 million people, 90 million people did not vote in the last election. I'm sure you hear this all the time. People say half of the country voted for Trump, but that's just not true because half of voters did not vote.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to point out. And then you've been on panels with Steve Levitsky, co-author of Tyranny of the Minority, and he and Daniel Ziblatt say we really need to have a conversation about how undemocratic this country is because of the Electoral College, because of gerrymandering. So given all of that, how do you describe the United States?
The United States today is solidly in this anocracy zone. It is no longer a full democracy, period, end of sentence. That is factually true, and anybody who studies democracy today will confirm that. And I think the reason Americans have such a hard time getting their mind around that is because when we think about democracy or when we think about governments, we think in this very, very black and white way. We think you're either a democracy or you're an autocracy. And when they think democracy, they're like, well, that's the United States because we've always been that. Or it's Canada and it's Switzerland, it's Western Europe, it's the world that the United States has lived in forever. And when they think about autocracy, they think about China and North Korea and Iran and countries that are so, so far away from America in terms of their politics, that there's no way we could ever become that. But they don't think about it as a continuum from North Korea to Denmark. And they don't think that there's this big middle zone called anocracy. And if you look at a whole series of outcomes, how a country does in terms of economic growth, how it does in terms of peace and stability, is it prone to war, how it does in terms societal calm. Almost all of the violence, almost all the bad things happen in the middle. So most Americans, when they think about democratic decline, in my opinion, don't worry about it that much because they think, oh, we are so far from China, a China and a North Korea and an Iran that we don't have to worry about. What they don't realize is that we're actually in this middle zone, and that's where most of the bad stuff happens.
So given what you're seeing from Trump and the Republican Party, and we should also talk about this, I'd love to find out how this compares to other countries. Republicans are afraid to stand up to Trump. We've had so many journalists on the show who say this country is heavily armed. I mean, you open your book writing about the plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and then there was that political assassination in Minneapolis just recently. So people are afraid. So there's that. And then I also wonder what your thoughts are about the role of money in politics, because it's almost like we don't talk about it anymore because it is so out of control. I just was reading and I didn't even realize it was this massive. Donors spent almost $5 billion just on the presidential election. We hardly even talk about this anymore. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, a Trump super PAC has raised $200 million for someone who cannot run again. So can you talk about those things and how that compares to other countries?
Well, they're related. Your question about like why are Republicans bowing to Trump? And then how, what's the role of money in politics? And they're related. Republicans are bowing to Trump for two reasons. The most important reason is that Trump is really popular with the Republican base. And to get back to your point earlier about who votes, to the people who vote for Republicans, for the people who actually get out of their homes, go to the polls or mail in their ballot, they love Trump. And if Trump says he doesn't like somebody, they don't vote for that person. So what you see Republicans in Congress and Republicans in the Senate doing, who actually are in districts where it's contested, is that they know if they don't bow to Trump, that they're either going to be primaried by a more conservative candidate who Trump is going to back, and lose in the primaries, or they can run and they're going to lose because Trump's supporters are not going to vote for them. So they're being very, very short-sighted and very self-interested. And they're making the decision that if I want to keep my job, I better support this guy no matter what. Money comes into play because the Supreme Court, and I think it was in 2015, made a ruling that set our democracy up for collapse. The Citizens United ruling, which allowed individuals in the United States to donate as much money as they wanted to their candidates, and the argument that they made was that this was a form of free speech, immediately injected deep corruption into our system. It meant that wealthy people, billionaires, people with unlimited resources, could essentially now directly buy influence. And it was a very successful strategy because the policies that have been enacted increasingly benefit corporations, business elites, and they've only gotten wealthier as a result. Those business elites have also been smart. They've been donating not just to Republican candidates, they've been donating to Democratic candidates. Mm-hmm. So Democrats who are frustrated with the sclerosis of their own party leaders, the unwillingness of people like Schumer or Jeffries to really fight back and fight to defend democracy, the fact that these Democratic leaders seem sort of stuck in a status quo that's not benefiting them is in part because they are aligned with business interests and they're benefiting financially from those campaign dollars, and they don't want to alienate these business interests by pushing for reform. So there's a whole series of things going on that has created a situation where Republicans in power are unwilling to stand up to Trump and fight for democracy. And Democrats in power, at least the old guard, are unwilling to stand up and demand reform, because reform would hurt the people who are donating money to their campaigns.
Today, we're speaking with Barbara Walter, Rohr Professor of International Relations at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego. She's author of How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them, and the Substack newsletter, Here Be Dragons, Warning Signs from the Edges of Democracy. Today, we continue our new weekly series, The Authoritarian Playbook. Every week, we'll summarize the news, put it in historical context, and find out how people are responding. So what's on your mind, given what we are seeing in D.C., Trump's threats to other cities like San Francisco and Oakland, the masked ICE agents who are violently grabbing people and putting them in unmarked cars, Trump firing so many government employees? There's just so much happening. What's on your mind? What questions do you have for Professor Barbara Walter? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Barbara, like our series on Project 2025, we decided to start this series, The Authoritarian Playbook, because we just aren't seeing enough legacy media outlets really connecting the dots. What are your thoughts about how the major media outlets are covering all of this?
Oh my goodness. Like, I want to fire the headline writer of the New York Times. I'm in New York. I grew up, was born and raised in New York. I have read the New York Times since I was a teenager. I still get it. The headlines are deeply misleading and deeply, in some ways, undemocratic. The major media outlets, some are better than others, but they still are stuck, I think, in this need to appear balanced, meaning that they can't criticize Trump without somehow criticizing the other side as well, and that is just a false dichotomy. If we were in the 1930s and Hitler got elected and he's beginning to take power, beginning to concentrate power, you don't say, well, what he's doing is sort of understandable given this, he claims that he doesn't want more territory in Eastern Europe, and we're going to believe him. You actually observe his actions and you hold him accountable. And I think American media is so afraid of being labeled as biased or as not, or of not appealing to the widest possible audience, that they are complicit in this new narrative that Trump is dominating. And then I think Trump is pure entertainment for some media outlets and pure gold. I think it brings in readers. So I think media outlets, even really reputable ones, are just worshiping at the feet of this golden entertainment god.
Can you say more about the role you think journalists should play at a time like this? And do you have examples of how journalists covered a slide toward authoritarianism or fascism in other countries?
So there are nonprofits out there that actually give guidelines to journalists for how to handle questions, for example, about political violence or about democratic decline or about a whole series of things. And I don't have those names at my fingertips, but they would be really easy to find via Google. Yeah. I do know that, you know, investigative reporting, there have been some stories that have just been absolutely phenomenal, where newspapers have taken a deep dive to really reveal what exactly has happened. The Wall Street Journal's recent article about Jeffrey Epstein was just a masterclass in this, where, you know, they did what journalists should do, is they pursued a story, an important story, a story that was going to piss off a bunch of people, but boy, it was going to inform the American public in a really, a very detailed, reliable way. And they went for it. And of course, Trump was angry, and I think Trump ended up suing them. But the courts are going to come down on the side of the Wall Street Journal, and that's exactly what should be happening. It's interesting, if you look historically at the countries that lost their democracies. So the Turkeys, the Brazils for a certain period of time, for Hungary, for Poland. They don't lose their democracy only because you have this wannabe dictator who's grabbing power. They also lose democracy because the opposition have remained quiet. And they remain quiet for lots of reasons. Sometimes they're just disorganized. Sometimes there's infighting amongst, you know, the opposing party. Sometimes they're just scared. But the opposing, the cases where democratic declines were halted, it's because opposition leaders, and here the opposition leaders would be the Democratic Party, they have stood up, they have spoken out, they've done what Pritzker did this week in Chicago. They have taken a stand. And that also includes journalists and teachers and university presidents and elites across the spectrum of society. And it also includes American citizens. When citizens stand up and they engage in nonviolent resistance, democratic declines almost always stop. So involvement by the other side is so critically important. And what you're seeing here in the United States since January is a whole lot of silence, with the exception of certain very few individuals, very few institutions here and there.
And there's a big, big march planned for Labor Day. About 1,000 rallies and protests are scheduled across the country. We'll talk more about this after a break, because in your recent Substack piece, How to Break a Tyrant, you write, it only takes 3.5% of the population to bring a regime to its knees if citizens know how to play the game. And that number comes from political scientist Erica Chenoweth, who's analyzed hundreds of resistance movements over the last century. So we'll talk about that after a break. Dr. Barbara Walter is Rohr Professor of International Relations at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego, and author of many books, including her latest, How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. Her Substack newsletter is called Here Be Dragons, Warning Signs from the Edges of Democracy. Today, we continue our new weekly series, The Authoritarian Playbook. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be joined by Ahmed Al-Nawk to talk about his new book, We Are Not Numbers, The Voices of Gaza's Youth. We Are Not Numbers was founded in 2014 to elevate the voices of young Palestinians who've endured unspeakable struggles and losses, who fight to be recognized not as numbers, but as human beings with hopes, dreams, and lives worth living. I hope you can join us tomorrow. And then on Friday, we will talk about the horrific Israeli bombings, the drones that killed 5 more Palestinian journalists. A few of them worked for the AP. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with Dr. Barbara Walter, Rohr Professor of International Relations at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. It's our new weekly series, The Authoritarian Playbook. We decided to do this because so much is happening so quickly. And like you, we just can't cover it all. We can't keep up with it all. But we'll do our best to summarize the news, put it in context, and then find out how people are responding. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Meg in Oakland. Hi, Meg. Thank you for holding.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My big question is, this all seems overwhelming. What can individual people do that can be really effective, especially people who are homebound? And if you could give specific examples, not just, oh, you have to stand up and resist. Good ideas that can actually work.
Yeah, thank you so much, Meg. Barbara, we've been hearing from so many people who say, I feel paralyzed. I don't know what to do. So what does work? And then if you can specifically talk about people who are homebound.
Yes. So what works is nonviolent resistance. And that could take lots of forms. That could be nonviolent protests. That could be strikes. That could be simply refusing to follow unconstitutional orders. That could be speaking up when you see injustice. That could be just a whole series of things where you simply don't voluntarily comply with what's happening. Especially, of course, if it's illegal. Going back to Erica Chenoweth's work, one of the things that she found was that nonviolent resistance was significantly more effective in toppling dictators, in getting significant political reforms, than any sort of violent resistance, including violent protests. And she also found that it doesn't actually take that much. You know, I think most people think, oh, you know, it's going to take, you know, million, it's going to take, you know, half the country rising up to get rid of Trump, or at least to demand that our leaders on the Democratic and the Republican side actually fix our democracy. And it doesn't. Here in the United States, it would only take about 12 million people. That's 3.5% of the population. That seems to be the magic number. In addition to that number, you need these nonviolent resistance movements to be broad-based. So you don't want just one segment of the population, the poor segment of the population. You want everybody from every walk of life out there. That puts pressure on business elites, that puts pressure on law enforcement, that puts pressure on our elected officials to actually change their behavior. So what works? If 3.5% of the population actually begins to resist what Trump is trying to do, and they do it in a sustained and broad-based way. It's shockingly effective. What can people who are housebound do? One of the interesting things about dictators and why is there's a paradox about dictators. They appear extremely strong on the outside, but they're actually quite weak. Weak meaning they're usually deeply unpopular. People don't like them. Even people in their inner circle don't like them. And the people who are there protecting them and sort of holding up their reign don't like them. But they remain in power because they portray themselves as invincible. So what people at home can do is simply voice that they don't like what's going on. Talk to as many people as they can and make it public that they don't agree with this. They see what's going on. They don't want this to continue to happen. What happens in societies with dictators is people go silent, and they're afraid that if they voice their opinion, they're afraid if their family or their neighbor knows that they're against the president, that something bad is going to happen to them. And when people start to go silent, the perception that starts to go through society is that people aren't speaking out because they actually like the leader, that the leader has support. And all that does is buttress this sense of strength that is fake. So speak out, let it be known, write notes to your editor in your local paper, you know, get on social media and let it be known to your family, your friends, your neighborhood, the rest of America, that you are somebody who doesn't support what's happening.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Meg. And again, the Labor Day strikes, you can find more information at maydaystrong.org. And I hope that helps, Meg. Let's go next to Anne in Washington, D.C. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you? I just wanted to make a comment because I did leave the city last weekend, and I took a road trip up to Buffalo, New York, and most of the driving that we did was through areas that were strong supporters of Trump. I don't think they've changed their ideas about Trump at all. In fact, I think their support seems to be stronger. And I did notice in the towns that we were driving through that they had pictures of veterans of all the wars. And, I mean, it wasn't just like a few signs somewhere. It was signs everywhere through many of the small towns. And I think that I kind of got the idea that military support in big cities didn't seem like a bad idea to them. And I mean, I really don't think that the whole country is on the same page with, you know, Trump being a dictator. I think that he really still does have a lot of strong support. And so I did want to leave that comment. And I also want to say, like, I think there's many reasons of why we're here. I don't think the only reason why we're here is because Trump is a dictator. And I think the Democrats should look at what they've done too to bring us here. And it's something that I feel like is needed in the media. So that was a comment that I wanted to leave. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for that comment. And I hope you can tune into the show on Tuesday. We're going to talk about really interesting studies that have looked at why 6 million people who voted for Biden did not vote for Harris. And these are Democrats or people, liberals. They're not Trump fans, let's just say that. But they're very angry about what's happening with the economy. And they just felt like the Democrats did not give them a reason to come out and vote. So there are so many layers to all of this. What are your thoughts on Anne's comment, Barbara?
Yeah, it's a great comment. And her comment about the Democrats, I think is true. You know, when Biden first came to office, in 2020 to 2022, he essentially had the same amount of power that Trump did in January. The Democrats had the White House, they had the House, they had the Senate, they had a majority in both of those houses. So he could have gotten a lot done, and he could have reformed our political system. He could have made our democracy stronger. And yet he either wasn't willing or wasn't able to do that. So it's kind of hard to take the Democrats seriously that they are really the party that's going to bring back democracy when they haven't really shown us a lot of evidence that they're willing and able to do that. So there's a lot of frustration that you'll talk about next week with the Democrats. But as somebody who studies democracy, I'm frustrated with them because they haven't really been able to help democracy in any way, and they continue not to be able to help it. And then her comment about upstate, I don't know if you want me to go into that or not.
Sure.
So what, you know, I've been thinking, like, why are Americans so complacent about this? Why aren't people doing more? And when I start to think about it, in many ways, it makes sense. Most people's lives are not impacted by this at all. They're not impacted by the ICE raids. They're not impacted by the National Guard in major cities. The economy still is solid. They haven't felt any pain or any very few negative repercussions of Trump. So if you were to close your eyes, if you were to turn off the liberal media outlets, you could easily go through life right now thinking everything's great. And there are days in my life when I think I should do that because I don't really want to live in this world of like constant doom. But most Americans are just going about their daily lives, and their daily lives are good. And their daily lives are very much like what their daily lives have been like for decades. The problem with autocrats and creeping authoritarianism is it often looks good at first before it gets really bad. And when it turns bad, it goes quickly. So it's almost the calm before the storm where you're like, the hurricane's coming, but suddenly everything's so calm and peaceful. And you're like, there can't possibly be a hurricane, 100 miles offshore. And then suddenly it comes. And that often comes in one of two forms, in the form of an economic crisis, where the economic fundamentals begin to collapse, or in some sort of emergency. And that could be an emergency that's crafted by a dictator, where suddenly there's a riot in Chicago, and it escalates quite quickly, and then Trump declares a state of emergency and martial law, or in the form of a war where the dictator, in order to sort of kick the door shut on democracy, fabricates a war so that he can, get rid of the Constitution. And, you start to see some of those things here. Trump has been talking more and more about the Mexican cartels and how the United States needs to go in there and do something about it. When dictators manufacture wars, they usually pick significantly weaker opponents. So Trump is not going to try to provoke a war with China or Russia. It's going to try to provoke a war, usually with a non-state actor. It's not going to provoke a war with Mexico directly, but with these cartels, which, Mexico, the Mexican government is unlikely to come down on the side of the Mexican cartels. That would be terrible politically. And so it's the perfect situation where you can suddenly say, hey, we are engaged in a war and the president needs extraordinary powers during this period of time.
Barbara Walter is professor of international relations at UC San Diego and author of How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. She writes the Substack newsletter, Here Be Dragons. In one of her latest pieces, she says the thing that scares me the most about this country's future is the police state. I want to play a clip, Barbara, that is very difficult to listen to, just to let listeners know, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. So the Lincoln Project recently posted a horrific video of a man being tackled to the ground by six officers. The Lincoln Project is a group of former Republicans who left the party because of Trump. And in the video, you will hear the man scream in Spanish, "I'm not a criminal. I'm not a criminal. I'm here to work. I didn't do anything. I want to be with my family." And his screams are very hard to hear. You will then hear from Rick Wilson, who is a former Republican strategist.
Yo no debo nada. Yo estoy trabajando. Yo no debo nada. Yo quiero estar con mi familia. Yo no soy criminal. Yo no soy criminal.
I'm not a criminal. I'm not a criminal. I'm here to work. I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. Those motherfuckers do not have a warrant. They do not present badges. They are masked men. I know that they don't believe this, but the Constitution specifically and explicitly, and listen, for all you Federalist Society goons who are still out there, for all you Republican rule of law types who supposedly believe the Constitution is a sacred document, it says that all persons, not citizens, all persons in the United States are entitled to due process of law. This is not due process of law. This is authoritarian cosplay bullshit. I've got to tell you something. Every one of these motherfuckers who is doing this behind abusing the power of the badge, behind a mask, no name tags, no warrants, no body cams, no identification, no paper trail, and they disappear, these people. I have a message for you folks. You are going to jail. This will end someday. You will be bankrupted by the people that you have abused because you will find that the idea that you thought that Trump would pardon you and you had sovereign immunity will be mistaken. These people doing this in our streets right now, they have formed essentially a secret police force on Trump's behalf. If this country does not understand what is happening at this point, you need to wake up. If you do not understand that if they can turn this police force against those people, they will turn it against you. They will turn it against American citizens, and they have. There are multiple, multiple cases now of American citizens being detained without access to an attorney, without a phone call, without a warrant, without probable cause, and at the hands of violent men who are unaccountable to the law. This will end someday. And people like Tom Homan and Stephen Miller, who are at the top of the food chain of this authoritarian unit, you can think you're going to ride around for the rest of eternity in your black and gold brand new cars with their President Trump ice wrap on them. This will end. The law will survive, and you will pay a price.
That is Rick Wilson, a former Republican strategist with the Lincoln Project. The screaming that you hear from this man went on for more than a minute, and we cut it down. It's just so hard to hear. I wonder what your thoughts are about Rick Wilson's comment, Barbara, that this will end someday and you will go to jail.
Well, I really hope he's right. I hope he's right. You know, all those people wearing masks, all the MAGA leadership, they understand that if they lose this game, they are going to jail. And so they have every incentive to make sure they don't lose. And we know that they're willing to play dirty. We know that they're willing to use violence. So I guess I really hope Rick Wilson is correct. And I hope that the American public don't allow this to happen. And I hope business elites will eventually see that supporting Trump is not in their interests or in their company's interests. But you know, all of the people supporting Trump understand what the potential repercussions are if they lose, and they're going to do everything possible to make sure that doesn't happen.
Do you think that this is just the beginning, that he's going to send troops to other cities?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, he's sending all the troops to deep blue cities. You know, look at his list, look at where he's sending them to. And he's doing this, you know, to ensure that he doesn't leave power in 2028, right? He's doing it as partisan, partly as an intimidation strategy to make sure people stay home and they don't vote in the next election in 2026 and then in 2028. He's doing it so that there are soldiers on the ground in case protests emerge. Again, we talked about 3.5% of the population rising up, and this being the quickest and easiest way to get rid of a dictator. Trump and his cronies know this. And of course, he wants to have soldiers in place to make that much more difficult. He also wants soldiers in place so that if protests emerge, and he needs to manufacture some security crisis, some emergency, that he'll have goons in place to provoke some sort of confrontation. And this then will allow him to put in place emergency dictates. So this is all part of his plan to eventually make sure that he never leaves the White House. He and his followers never leave the White House.
And Barbara, we should say that some troops in D.C. are now armed. And I've been hearing interviews with former high-level members of the National Guard who say these are mostly young guys who do not have any training really dealing with this kind of violence that Trump says is happening on the streets. And I've heard people say they're afraid, you know, what if five people run toward an armed guard and he shoots someone? What happens then?
Nobody really knows, but you know, things can get out of control very quickly. And I think what's so disturbing is that if things get out of control quickly, it doesn't necessarily hurt Trump. It actually might help Trump because then it confirms or it provides evidence that he can then spread on social media with misleading headings saying, look, you know, our cities are out of control. They're filled with violent criminals. Look what they're doing. And all of that can be doctored to make the rest of the country believe everything Trump is saying. And then, of course, Trump turns around and says, I have to send in more troops and I have to I'm going to declare martial law. So all of this plays into his plan to eventually get rid of democracy.
Barbara Walter is Rohr Professor of International Relations at UC San Diego and author of How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. She also writes the Substack newsletter, Here Be Dragons, Warning Signs from the Edges of Democracy. Thank you for your work, Barbara. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And we didn't have time to play this clip, but you probably have heard about Trump's executive order instructing the attorney general to pursue cases against people who, quote, incite violence while desecrating the symbol of the country, the United States flag. And a veteran was arrested for burning the flag in D.C. There are a number of veterans who are protesting in front of the White House because they disagree with Trump sending guard troops to D.C. and then possibly other cities. So veterans are on the streets protesting. And again, there are major May Day protests planned for Labor Day. You can find more information at maydaystrong.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.